Hey, sweet people, welcome back to another episode of the Sweet Spot Podcast, where we explore the essence of what makes people and brands unique and successful. I'm your host, Mark Zeus, and today we are diving deep into the realm of storytelling and archetypes with a very special guest. My guest this week is from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam. This is why this episode is in English. Joining me today is the Jungian psychologist, Suzanne Schrewe. We embark on a journey through the ages, from the philosophical musings of Plato to the groundbreaking works of Carl Gustav Jung, Freud, all the way to the modern storytelling landscape for marketing, movies, entertainment. So we really want to explore archetypes and storytelling fundamentals to really get a deeper understanding of what drives us as humans when it comes to storytelling, to identification with stories, and how we can use this for ourselves, for our ideas and creative endeavors. Together with Suzanne, we will uncover the timeless wisdom that is embedded in myths and fairy tales, and the human psyche for that matter, and we will explore how the understanding of these narratives can empower us as creatives, as entrepreneurs, to craft compelling stories that resonates with our audiences, with our clients, on a deeper level, and that helps us to bring meaning and to push our ideas forward. So whether you're seeking inspiration for brand building, honing your creative skills, or simply intrigued by the art of storytelling, this episode is packed with insights, news, and tips, and a really deep understanding of storytelling that will help you find and share your sweet spot. So stay tuned as we unlock the secrets of storytelling and archetypes with Suzanne Schrewe. I'm Mark Zeus. This is the Sweet Spot Podcast. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Sweet Side. This is the Sweet Spot Podcast with Mark Zeus, investigating entrepreneurship, purpose, and the creative life.
Suzanne, welcome to the podcast. So nice to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks. I'm really excited about this conversation. Today we get the opportunity to dive into a topic that we usually scratch the surface of. When I talk to creatives from all fields, movie makers, illustrators, painters, musicians, oftentimes archetypes come up, storytelling come up, but I never before had the opportunity on air to talk to someone who actually studied this and really goes deep into this, into these topics. So I'm really excited, and I think the audience, the sweet people listening, will be as well. Yeah. So cool. So as I mentioned before, you studied behavioral neuroscience and also Jungian psychology. So maybe first of all, when you hear these topics in everyday life, how does it feel if you hear archetypes and storytelling being thrown around in marketing and movies? Is this like in some form rooted in the science, or is it just some very, very simplicity knockoff?
That's such an interesting question to begin with, because you immediately bring it into the public domain. Yeah. Well, there's no real one answer to the question, actually. It's very much layered. And I would have to backtrack it to how the idea of archetypes entered into the modern domain. Okay. I think that would be our
Let's start there.
Point.
That's a good starting point.
Well, first of all, the idea of archetypes was not new. Mm-hmm. You have, for instance, Plato's idea of forms, in which he referred to the idea or to the phenomenon of form as an idea, as something mm-hmm. that exists before it goes into the physical material. And Jung, when he was working together with Freud in the beginning of the 1900s, Freud was already working with dreams, and Jung just jumped on that bandwagon, and they had a very tight working relationship. It was a bit like a father-son relationship. Mm-hmm. Freud is the father, young as the sun.
Sounds super healthy right away.
It does, doesn't it? Jung worked in psychiatric hospitals, so he was a trained psychiatrist and psychologist. And as he was watching the dreams of the patients that he had, which were mostly schizophrenic patients, what he saw was that there were collective elements coming back and recurring across the patients. So similar motives, similar symbols, and at the same time, he also saw them reflected in mythology and stories. So he came to the idea of archetypes. Well, this is one of the ways he came to the idea of archetypes as something that is very much at the core of the human psyche that is not necessarily conscious, but it's spans across time and space, and it will have similar symbols, it will have certain attributes, it will have certain qualities. And that is what sort of kickstarted this. Now there's another important element to this is when he had a dream that showed him the structure of the psyche. And in this dream, he begins in a house, and at the top of the house is not his house, but it feels like his house. And it's in the period of time when he is alive. And then he descends one step lower, and he goes into a more ancient room with more ancient furniture. And then he goes lower again into the basement. And into the basement, there's Roman ruins and a slab. And again, a completely different time period. And he opens the slab up and dives into this cave. And in the cave, there are bones and pottery from ancestors a long, long time ago. And as he woke up from this dream, he gathered that what he was in were the layers of the psyche. So you start with the conscious, the daily waking life, the things that we know, also known as the ego. Then you dive a little bit lower. You call it the personal unconscious. These are the things that we've repressed that are not allowed to be here from our parents or society, that are really within the personal influence. And then you go even lower into the collective unconscious. Now, the collective unconscious is an important term because that's where you find the archetypes. They come from that space. Yeah, how did this enter into our modern culture? Yeah. Well, it was a rough road because, first of all, Jung was a pariah. He was outcasted. And, you know, he had this whole spiritual notion as well, this idea of the collective unconscious, it being a soul. He even talked about that. So all the academics.
He took it further then, right? He was into spirituality and things a lot, and openly, though, as a scientist, which was out there at the time, I guess.
Well, absolutely. It was so much out there that he got outcasted. And there's a break with Freud there as well, very important. And he then goes into this 9-month madness, which you could almost call divine madness, because out of that comes the Red Book, and the Red Book holds all the imagery that will later become the blueprint for the development of Jungian psychology. Once this psychology, once it starts to gain traction and he gains more clients and more people are interested, you know, it starts to sort of have a life on its own, and you have post-Jungian scholars and Jungian analysts such as James Hillman, but for instance also Joseph Campbell. And this is where you might recognize
the hero's journey, of course.
Exactly. And this is where it really enters into the public sphere, because not just is the psyche sort of explained in structure, but also how these mythological stories with universal themes move us and influence us. And it sort of becomes a handbook at one point for story makers, for filmmakers, and eventually also for marketing.
100%. And so what we're going to dive into this really deep, but the first thing that comes to mind, if I listen to this, and for the sweet people listening, I'll put all of these books in the show notes so they will they can look up the Red Book and things about Jung, and also Joseph Campbell, Hero with the Thousand Faces, I think, which is the, as far as I know, the fundamentals, the groundwork for the hero's journey as we know it today. It's there in 10 and 12 steps and I think 17 or 18 steps. So it's different versions, but they all revolve around the same hero journey, so to speak, which we find in old fairy tales, old myths, and again in most of superhero movies and all of that stuff today, but in a more simplified way.
Yeah,
let's put it that way. And what I'm the first thing I want to ask you, in your opinion, is when you work either as an entrepreneur or a creative, an artist in whichever sense, and you try to approach this, there's always two sides which you can approach it. One is, as you mentioned, as Jung itself did, like following your dreams and intuition and listening in to maybe find ideas and models and maybe even archetypes that fit you. And the other thing is if you try to use it as a navigation. And this is something I have a lot of debate with both clients and companies, but also creators about it. How do you think you can use archetypes and that term storytelling? Can you just use it like an interpretation of where you are, who you are, where to direct maybe? Or can you also use it as a kind of a compass? Like, okay, I want to develop into this direction. What does this archetype mean? I'm maybe more grounded in my, say, shadow archetype, or in an archetype that doesn't perfectly suit my aims and my mission or even vision for life. Do you think you can consciously navigate into the direction or travel into a direction of these archetypical ideas, or is it more of, okay, it's a map, let's see where I am and what my strengths and weaknesses are and where I maybe should focus more on?
That's a great question. It's a two-way road, I believe. It goes back and forth. But there's this quote from Jung, which I really like, which comes from his book in Man and the Symbols, and he says, "The one thing we refuse to admit is that we are dependent upon powers beyond our control." So in that respect, that would answer one side of your question, where these archetypes are also seen as the riverbeds of life. We used to call them the gods and goddesses. And interestingly, the name, the old ancient Greek name for therapy, therapeutes, also means to tend to the gods and goddesses. And only later did it get the meaning of intending to heal. Or a facility to heal, to service even. So from coming from the inner space, there, when working with archetypes, there, I think there's one thing that people might tend to skip, is that you're working with some very powerful forces. And it takes a certain respect and attitude that is needed to approach them. And a lot of the stories will show you this. So there is the predominant hero's myth. But there's a bit of an issue with that myth, because it's a very patriarchal myth. So if you were to look more at fairy tales rather than myths, in the fairy tales, you always see that there's this struggle and their task to be fulfilled rather than something to be conquered.
Yes.
And that's a very important differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
And you also are asked to suffer life in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Not to win, not to conquer it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the idea of working with archetypes and with the unconscious and with this inner journey is very much about learning to navigate life, which throws all of these things at you without moving into escapism or into fighting it.
Yep.
But at the same time, you need a very good, settled ego
mm-hmm.
to navigate this path.
Mm-hmm.
And ego has gotten a little bit of a bad rep in
recent history. Know. Yeah, 100%.
Ego is a bad thing, but because it it's often associated with selfishness. But ego actually just means, in Jungian terms, means being conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to make decisions and also being able to listen to the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that you work with archetypes and the more that you pull out from the depths, that would be your conscious intention to navigate this path mm-hmm. and to try and find your way. The more you are also given and the more you are also initiated into surrendering into the unknown.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good quote. Surrendering into the unknown. Suzanne, maybe before we dive into fairy tales and myths and a maybe modernized idea on archetypes, for all listeners who maybe heard of it but didn't dive into it really deeply, how have you experienced coming across the archetypes for the first time? It's maybe long ago, but how did you experience this? And was there immediate resonance with, oh, I feel drawn to a certain archetype? Or have you made the experience that you really need someone with a lot of experience, knowledge to guide you towards your archetype? And second half of that question is, what impact did it have knowing which archetype maybe resonates with you?
That's again a really good question. First of all, archetypes do not necessarily have to be individuals. They can be trees, they can be animals, they can be elements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you go into the core of an archetype, you'll actually end up with the elements of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that probably it would have been Gaia. If I think about it now, I've never thought about the question. The one thing I definitely had in my life, I mean, the first archetype you encounter is your mother
mm-hmm.
And your father, but the ones that stood out for me on the outside, I'll make a distinction between the outside and the inside. The outside was nature. Because I grew up on a farm mm-hmm. and it was my absolute place of consolation, of joy, of the miraculous, of wonder. And
yep.
that would be Gaia, absolutely, mm-hmm. like holding me. And the other archetype is that I grew up with my grandmother. So there's this ancient bond that happens that you actually see much more in fairy tales, which is the maiden and the crone
mm-hmm.
And how they bond. And the crone, like a Frauhole
mm-hmm.
or Perchta, mm-hmm. she guides the maiden into adulthood. So I had that.
Yeah.
And I have really treasured and carried that for a long time. Because it also deepened my connection with Gaia itself, because my grandmother was also, she was like a Zen Buddhist. She could look at images of nature for hours and,
mm-hmm.
and get lost in it. And she would take me on that journey. And then on the inside, I had this absolute crazy longing for a soulmate, as long as I can remember. Maybe this was fed by all the Disney stories, very possible. But it was really strong. But interestingly, the moment that I got into Jungian psychology and I found out about what the journey actually of individuation leads to, individuation being the development of the self or the coming into the self, into soul, as a wholesome personality, is the conjunctio, the sacred marriage between the masculine and the feminine within, the union of the opposites. And that suddenly all made sense to me. I was like, okay, so I'm what I'm longing for on the outside is absolutely within.
Well, that's thank you for sharing, because that's I think a deep insight. But again, today, if you talk about, you are very aware of the archetype of your grandmother and Gaia, but growing up, you weren't aware that these are archetypes and what impact they might have. So for everyone listening who was maybe aware of archetypes, but I'm really interested in the moment that you became aware of this, and how did it change you, or how did it affect you actually? In the sense of, okay, now I know this. Now, oh, I get it. It's a grandma archetype. It's nature. It's Gaia. Did this help you, challenge you? Was it something like, okay, now the pieces fall into place? How did you work with that?
I think my moment was slightly different, but I can tell you a very definite moment. And I had already been introduced by archetypes, but for a while, but I wasn't really consciously working with it. It was really only until I read a paper in class that was homework that explained to me that the archetypes are the riverbeds of life, and that changed me. And suddenly everything made sense, that there is this power, this force that is bigger than me, that steers things, and that I am not always in control of that. And that was an aha moment, absolutely. I don't know how it changed me afterwards specifically. I think it slowly started to embed and seeded this deep respect for the inner worlds, for the gods and goddesses of old, and to not work with them just lightly, not to use them, because they have all sides. They have this spectrum of qualities, so they can show their good side, they can show their bad side as well.
And which would be the archetype and the shadow archetype, maybe?
Yeah, it's when it's in the shadow. So when the most important thing, first of all, with archetypes is being steady in your ego, so you don't get taken over necessarily. The shadow is usually referred to something that is within the personal unconscious, and not in the collective unconscious. So that's a little bit closer to you, and you work through that. But when you get to the archetypal level, you're just working with a spectrum of behaviors and traits that range from the very destructive to the very life-giving. And it oscillates between those two. And it's about being able to recognize when it comes up and either giving into it or not. That's how we work with them. And in this reciprocal relationship, they evolve as well. They get to move. They get to change. And that's, I think that's one of the most exciting and cool things.
Okay. So before we, I know that you have your own idea, which I find very intriguing, about archetypes and how they maybe develop. But before we go into this, I'm really, because you mentioned fairy tales before, and coming from Germany, growing up with all the Grimm's, Brother Grimm, fairy tales and stuff, now knowing they just collected them, most of them, and they also changed it to the zeitgeist, to the societal rules that took place, to Christianity and all of that. So a lot of these Grimm fairy tales are not their original forms. Mm-hmm. And going back, at least that's the part of my understanding and recent discoveries I can share, and then I want to hear your thoughts on it. But reaching back in time to where these myths come from, without the Christian archetypes or the trimming and slimming down of the fairy tales to suit a new value system, fit into the Christian canon, so to speak. And then going back to myths. And I think it's super interesting if you look at these ancient, maybe original, old fairy tales, and also into mythology from other countries, like Northern mythology, which is very close to Northern Germany. So I hear that, I get that a lot, which, like these old Nordic gods or fairy tales and myths, they don't have any kind of morality to them, which I found very intriguing, very interesting. Gods, they drink, they fuck around, they kill, there's no sense of right or wrong or this one big justice that says, oh, you can and can't do this. It's more, it's very, very different towards what we see today. And some ancient myths also served the more tribal everyday life, maybe. Mm-hmm. There was, for example, this one myth when a man went away into the war and a woman got pregnant. While her husband was away, it was considered an honor because there was some kind of, I forgot his name, but there was one god of fertility and new life and everything, and he visited her. So it was an honor to have this child, that extramarital child, so to speak. So I think that was a fantastic way of building a myth around something that occurred in their everyday life. To bring peace, to honor life, and stuff like that. So yeah, that's my two cents. And now I'm really interested in where you stand on which myths or fairy tales do you consider most helpful or more insightful when it comes to psychology and archetypes. What do you look at? Which fairy tales do you read or research?
Well, first of all, I want to respond, I'd like to respond to this immorality. Sure. And I also like that a lot. And one of the things that I enjoy about mythology, that yes, there's a psychological element to it, but also there's another element to it. So storytelling has been used as a way to store information very accurately.
Yes.
Being passed on from generation to generation, and it still to date is the most efficient way to transfer a whole bunch of information for the longest period of time.
Yeah.
And information is about not just about our place in the universe, but it's also about what to do when a snake comes, or what to do when there's a storm brewing. It has information about how we are with animals, or how we're supposed to live in harmony or in symphony with our more than human kin. So this element of nature is important when looking at the immorality of these myths, because it's sort of reflecting that immorality that is very much in nature itself.
Yeah. And yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and that's this really nice thing, because we have very much moved away from our instincts, and that's what myths do for us at the moment. We live in this post-Cartesian time when, with rationality and the period of enlightenment, and you have this big splits between matter and spirits, and myths bring us back into our bodies, into this instinctive nature that we all have. Mm-hmm. So which ones would I go to, which is your question? I love the gritty fairy tales.
Me too, yeah.
The dark ones, the strange ones. They're in myths. I do, coming back to a question that you had before, that what are your personal myths? Mm-hmm. At one point, you do start to find out what your personal myth is by just getting to know them. And you can also look at what story did you like most when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that would have been the story of Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I started to get fascinated by the story of Isis and Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
And within fairy tales, there are stories like the dark versions of Cinderella stories, or the dark versions of the crone, but also creation stories.
Yeah.
So creation stories throughout the world, I think, are beautiful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, going back, I remember my... when I was growing up, I was crazy about spooky stories.
Yeah.
But really, like, to the degree that my mom was worried, like, it has to be vampires and ghosts and everything. I wasn't scared at all. I just found it so fascinating. Mm. And all the, I can't remember the Disney movies, but I think all the ones that were a little spooky, like Beauty and the Beast, but for the Beast, of course, not for the singing little cups, but for the, you know? Yeah, yeah, that stuff. But yeah, a follow-up question towards that. You just said something very interesting, that you say myths and stories have the possibility or the power to bring us back into the now, our bodies, into the present. Do you think this is one of the reasons why I feel like, as a society, at least Western society, but I guess it's a global thing, we're absolutely story addicted. And everyone is talking about attention economy and time gets experienced, like time is less and less and we're more stressed. And at the same time, the consumption of stories in whichever form, can be podcasts, Netflix, binge watching for hours, movie releases, superhero movie part 48, we're so addicted to stories. Do you think they still hold the power of myths and fairy tales and like this ancient storytelling tradition? Definitely not all of them, because there's a more simplified way of telling stories today. But do you think this is one of the reasons why we're so story addicted and driven?
Oof, this is interesting.
To make it follow up or to be more precise, do you think it's resonating with something deeper, or do you think it's escapism? Because I'm never sure.
No, exactly. I was hanging out in the same space there. I think there's not one good answer, because it's so person dependent. But collectively, I think it's both. I think there's a deep longing, because myths, the old myths and the old fairy tales, they hold still symbols of universal resonance that plows much deeper into us than you can ever know. I think there's this beautiful Sufi expression where they say that an original word has seven different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And you never know, you know, you don't consciously actually get to the seventh, or perhaps you're enlightened then, I don't know. But the same goes for symbols, the images that reflect the archetype that carries them. They also have these deeper meanings. And if you're going to use symbols in a way that doesn't reflect these deeper meanings, they lose that resonance. And I think if you look at most modern stories, they don't carry that.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something with binge watching. I can do that as well.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, and I definitely used to do it a lot. And I'm getting a little bit, I've been watchful about it, although I can obviously still get caught up. With that, what happens for me, and I don't know if this resonates for you or for those who listen, but it sort of fills my capacity to imagine by myself. And the whole purpose of mythology is to bring you into the world of imagination, the imaginary, which is also a spiritual realm. And if you keep on filling yourself with images and images and images, you clog up the system. And you sort of thwart that realm. It sort of gets infected in a way. So there, that's a different working than exposing yourself to a storytelling with all of your body, with all of your senses. It's a completely different way of listening and receiving than binge watching.
So how would you, or what's your recommendation? Because I think this resonates with a lot of people, also with me. The need to, the addiction of being entertained, listening, watching stories, all of that, sometimes you get clogged up. How would you detox, or at least trim it down to being able to experience a story fully again?
Yeah, so not an easy question, because there's, it, again, it depends on the person. If you're someone who can easily say no, then that would be the way, and to be conscious.
Yeah.
But usually there are a lot bigger forces behind this. And that's what makes it difficult for us to pull ourselves away. But the first step is to be conscious, to think about, well, one of the ways that I dealt with it is, for instance, what kind of stories am I attracted to? And get curious about the content that I'm attracted to. And then just think about that a little bit. So why am I attracted to this? What could it symbolize? What could it mean? And because if the images are trying to fill something, then, you know, there's something underneath there that is wanting to get attention. And that is shadow. And that's where you want to go to.
That's interesting. That's nice.
Yeah. So what shadow part is trying to get my attention? And then you can even go into a voice dialogue with that part. So imagine that your psyche exists out of all of these archetypes, all of these entities. And if you run it like a democracy where everyone has a seat at the table, you don't have to go into TV watching anymore to go to that element inside of you that's actually maybe wanting to get attention.
Yeah.
So that, I would say that would be one way to approach it. Another way to approach it is to, whenever you watch, whenever you do go watching, just be conscious. Just consciously step into the TV watching. Don't beat yourself up when you get out of it. And be kind.
Investigating what you long for, that's a very interesting part of it. Also, this is more, maybe a lot of people can relate. Maybe that's just me. I don't think so. But, you know, for me, it's always this balancing act. When I work, may it be design or more free artistically, whatever, half the time, at least, I want some kind of input. I either work in a cafe, or I listen to music, or I have something on in the background, not as a distraction, but this really helps me focus, because sitting in quiet is like I'm at three places all at once. Not because I'm especially creative or gifted or whatever. I have a freaking focus problem. That's more of it. So a lot of, there's something playing, something in the background constantly, is more of a, this really helps me to focus. If you have to fight a little fight of attention on the side, this is really helpful to go into something. Is that something you consider looking into, or is this just a way of working and practicing attention?
Well, I actually have the same thing. I love being in cafes, because the more noise around me, the more I get into this bubble of concentration. And I don't know if it fits into the conversation of archetypes.
That's possible.
Even though it is a good question, I would have to sit on it and maybe get back to you on it.
We can do that. Yeah? No worries. Yeah, of course.
Just let it hang there in the space.
So something else that I think some listeners might have stumbled over this, because if you look at archetypes like in the classical original sense, if there's a set of original archetypes, so to speak, and then you mention different ones, Gaia is maybe a little bit out of the ordinary classic thing, but in our conversation we had before recording, you talked about a very different set of archetypes. So you kind of took this concept and moved it onwards, or you rethinking the whole thing. And I'm very interested in this, because I guess listeners picked that up by now, that there's a more open approach to what archetypes can be, in your opinion. So maybe you can guide us through this process of, okay, what's the considered classical set of archetypes, and how do you rethink them, or why did you start to open that up and say more things can be considered archetypical?
I think you're referring to, and just correct me if if I'm wrong, I think you're referring to the classical Jungian idea, is that archetypes are set at their core. Mm-hmm. And then they can change. So they transform. They transform in relation with you. And what you see looking, at least what you see looking in Western society, is that archetypes started to sort of fragment into multiple facets. So maybe a goddess who would have held certain qualities like goddess of war, but goddess of the underworld, goddess of birth, goddess of the upper world, goddess of love, goddess of the middle world, would all exist within the one archetype. And then as we started to differentiate ourselves as humans, differentiate our ideas about who we are, our logos got a larger role to play in a predominantly animism type of religious lifestyle, which had been there for thousands, tens of thousands of years. We start differentiating, and so you can see that reflecting in the goddesses being sort of fragmented as well, and the gods and the archetypes into all these different facets, which brings us to now. And I think it's just interesting how people in our society, they can easily sort of identify archetypes, identify little pockets of people that may be a little bit like this or be a little bit like that. We talked about this yesterday. Which ones did we call out? Well, there's, in my country, in the Netherlands, you have the puer, the adult man who looks very young. And
Peter Panish archetype.
The Peter Panish archetype.
Like a modernized or localized Peter Pan version. Yeah.
And so there's much more, in a way, there's much more fluidity. And I don't know necessarily if I'm different in this thinking than other people.
Maybe I have to say at this point that I'm not as deep into archetypes as you are. So I always considered them to be like mostly the ones you meet on the hero's journey, right? Magician and the trickster and all of these, and then you have a mother archetype and all of that. But when we talk, you say, oh yeah, that's like Peter Pan is kind of an archetype, which is new. I mean, he belongs to some category, but it feels like you modernize them, or you take him out of the old mythological context and you place them in today's narrative, so to speak. And this is just something that came to my attention, and I wanted to ask about this.
I'm definitely not new in this, or this is not my spiel on things. So the puer comes from Jung himself, and the Jungian psychology, for instance. But yeah, what you do as a Jungian analyst or therapist is that you want to apply it to the modern day. You want to be able to recognize all these different forces at work and how they recollate themselves, or, you know, it's I just imagine it as this whirl, this stream of energy, or this whirl of an archetype that sort of constellates itself differently in this point in time. And it will reflect, will reflect the time, the spirit of the time, there will always be something at the core of it which will reflect the spirit of the depths.
Yeah.
And that is an important interaction between these archetypal manifestations and the time itself. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm trying to connect my follow-up question to this thought. Because, I mean, okay, let's stretch this out a little bit. Because there's one common narrative with all the podcasts, interviews I had, at least for the people who I considered have received their calling, so to speak. They found meaning in what they do, like deep meaning. This can be an entrepreneur who started a company but gives everything, his whole set of values, what drives him, his own personal story, his belief systems into this company. Or, of course, you have creators and artists who express that in everything they do, basically. So, but one common idea with the people that are really involved into finding something that is meaningful to them is that they consider their whole life, basically, in a pretty much a story approach. So everything you look back at is your past, is the story you tell yourself, which is not a new idea, so to speak, but meeting people who really can execute this and really cultivate this has a big change and impact in their life. Like, okay, do I focus on everything that went wrong in the past, to give a very simple example, or do I focus on that one failed relationship or whatever in the past? And you give that space and meaning and power over the whole narrative of your life, basically. So considering your life and the potential you have in your life is basically a story. This is one of the key reasons I'm so interested in talking to people like you and on this podcast, because I really think that our idea of story and archetypes and all of this shapes our life and this whole life experience. And then, so this is the overarching idea, but then what to me is really interesting when you find that meaning, or better, maybe you rediscover it. I think as a child you have a lot of what's meaningful and important just very easily laid out to you, and it's very playful, and then everything gets in the way, from school to making money to societal rules and expectations and all of that stuff. But if you can pierce through all of this and find what gives meaning to you again, you're on a fantastic track, I would say. And then you have life events that change your, maybe not change your trajectory, but add something. For example, becoming a mother is, you tap into becoming an archetype yourself that you before received in a very different way. You've always been a child, a grandchild in your case, having a strong bond with your grandmother. And then you, I don't know if you awaken it or it comes into you or you switch or you activate it or whatever, you become a new, or you integrate a new archetype into your life. And yeah, first of all, I mean, how was that experience for you, if you don't mind sharing that?
Oh, amazing. Yeah, amazing. It was so transformative. That becoming a parent, I believe, can be one of the most transformative periods in a lifetime, because it is such a switch. But you don't have to become a parent to receive the mother archetype. So the mother archetype is really about mothering, if you turn it into a verb. You you know, it's tending, it's taking care, but you also have many faces to the mother archetype, like the death mother, the mother that wants to gobble everything up. You see that in nature when mothers eat their children. So there's this whole spectrum of the mother archetype that you encounter, and it can be overwhelming. So if you're not, usually if the basic components are not well set into place, that there's some sort of basic ease, then these archetypes can become quite overwhelming.
So basic ease within you as a
as a person.
As a whole personality.
Yeah, as a person, yeah. So when I had my daughter, through pregnancy, obviously you open up into the archetype. You can open up into the Mother Mary archetype. And that's logical if you live in a Western society and you have sort of a Christian background. But you also have the other side. And I encountered that when I first became a mother, and also was confronted with incredible feelings of loss or despair or frustration. I feel it's important when you go through these major transitions to have some sort of practice in place, be it art, be it meditation, be it whatever. Actually, it doesn't really matter, but it's something that really grounds you, and it allows you to work out these energies that you are given, that you are exposed to, so they have a place to go. Because it will, big transitions mean big energy. Big energy, you can imagine, it's like standing underneath a waterfall, but you know, you're hollow, so it touches everything, and anything that's in the way, it will get touched. It will want to move through. It will want to flush out. It will want to transform, and that's what initiation periods like motherhood, parenthood, or perhaps working on a project. That's what they're all about. Does that answer?
Yes, I was curious about your personal experience.
Yeah.
And as a follow-up, I am interested in, I mean, there's so many archetypes. I don't know if it's a belief or if there's science behind it. Can everyone embody or implement every archetype, or is there a limit to what you can hold or incorporate or embody? And are there maybe... This is a very naive question, but I really don't know I haven't studied it and I haven't read up everything about it. So I'm really interested in if you can embody like negative archetypes for yourself, or you have the wrong idea. I mean, especially with Western society, how archetypes got hollowed out and slimmed down and trimmed to fit some entertainment narrative or other narratives. I believe you can try and aim for the wrong archetypes for yourself, or embody something that's not right for you. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we get into a really fascinating space here, because to answer the first part of your question, the Jungian idea, but also the esoteric notion of soul, means to hold, to contain all. So everything is inside of you. And everything is at least inside of your soul. And your soul is inside of something much greater, which also contains everything, which is the anima mundi. So I'm really glad you raised it, because the anima mundi concept of the world being ensouled, and us being a part of that, is incredibly important in this day and age, because we often look at archetypes and we look at Jungian psychology or working with mythology for our own purpose and a purpose of self-growth, but it was never about that. It was never about serving yourself. It was always about serving the greater good, serving the world, about knowing how to live in kinship with each other, about how to act, about how to remember, and how to be. And so looking up archetypes, in a sense, again, you would want to question yourself, why, what is driving me to do this? What is driving me to go there? And I don't believe in the wrong archetype. I believe, because archetypes, there is no wrong archetypes. There's no good archetype. Each archetype, as I said before, it has a spectrum. And on the one hand, it can destroy, and on the other hand, it can birth life. And so it is all about, for me, it is all about the way that you approach it and why.
Yes.
What is the motivation? And if you are going to go there with a selfish motivation, you're going to feel it. You're going to get it reflected back. And that is what the stories tell us.
That's the how and maybe the why. Let's dive into this. How would you recommend anyone listening to this who's not in touch, who maybe didn't investigate this further so far, what would you recommend taking the first steps? I mean, of course, they can maybe be in touch with you or another Jungian psychologist. But other than this, is there a way that everyone can take first steps, think differently about it? What would you recommend?
Take a deep breath. Understand or know somewhere that you're working with great forces, great beings, and feel into yourself what would be an honorable way to approach someone. Which way do you express respect? For instance, if you want to tell a story or you want to approach Kali, for instance, great fierce goddess, but also loving mother goddess, look at the cultures in which the tradition of honoring and being respectful is still intact. So look to the indigenous culture, look to India, and learn from it, but you don't need to copy it. Find your own way of honoring something, and just take your time, don't rush. And take it step by step. What I do with clients, for instance, when we encounter our archetypes in dreams, is that you voice dialogue, you can draw, you can give shape to the archetype with clay, be creative, and keep in mind, you know, that you are meeting someone for the first time, so it's, you can't claim anything. It's given to you.
Okay, that's very no, that's a nice approach. That's very different to step 1 to 7, but this is due to the depth, I think, of this topic, and it's really interesting, because what you said is really, I mean, it's worth every all the energy you put into it, and all worth every try. Because as you mentioned, you told this story about, I think it was Jung who dreamt about this house with this different floors, and going deeper and understanding that these are maybe the archetypes and everything. And this within itself is such an, to me, it's such an archetypical image, because circling back to your life as a story and your role and your understanding of it being grounded, besides other things, in this understanding of psychology and archetypes. If you have this dream, or whatever happens to you, it could be a dream, could be things you experience, what you make of them is always your mindset. Is such an overused word these days, but where you are and what you aim for and what you find meaning in is what you're going to make of everything. And I love this, because if an architect would have had that dream, it's like, fantastic, I'm going to build a house like this, right? Yeah. Or if you're an archaeology buff, you might say, oh wow, yeah, I have to go deeper, I can layer a museum like this, or, you know, whichever one it is, what you are, where you look for and where you find meaning in is what you make of everything, be it dreams, people you meet, things that happen to you. So again, I'm just trying to make a pitch for the sweet people listening, mm-hmm. to really take the time and investigate this, because I think this will impact every part of your life, especially if you're on to a creative journey or a journey where you say, okay, I take things in my own hands, I want to build something, create something, change something. Mm-hmm. It's even more, or it's very worth your while to investigate things like this. Yeah.
And to just respond to that, what came to mind for me is that especially artists, creative people, but also entrepreneurs, once you create or develop a certain skill set, skill sets are also part of archetypes, and the archetypes, they will come once you have a certain skill set that you embody, then mm-hmm. they can come and use that through mm-hmm. you. There are times I remember when I had it with sports, when I played hockey, that I had a certain skill set, and that I remember playing, being there but not really being there. Don't know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that is, I think that is the magic. That's of being in the flow, mm-hmm. where things can just go from one world into the other, and the and back up again, and or back in again. And then the other thing that I felt was important to add to this is that the real nitty gritty things of daily life are so important when you start working with the archetypes as well, because you need to stay grounded. So the very simple things of doing your dishes, mm-hmm. keeping your house clean, that mundane part really anchors you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and important when you start to, if you start to consciously work with archetypes and you get more into that psychic realm, then it needs to be balanced.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe one more question that I have concerning this is, when we talked before about it, we had this great question coming up. How have you experienced archetypes manifesting in people? And I mean, we talked about how it changes people, how you can look into it, how you find it for yourself. But what's your experience in manifestation in people?
It can be in the most luminous way, and it can be in the most horrific way. So I can see when someone gets really angry that the anger becomes them. Mm-hmm. And usually when something becomes you, then it's an archetype coming through, and then you're being asked to investigate this, and to work on something. So that's one way, and that's a very that can be a more extreme way. When it goes into those kind of emotions and violence, and another way, a very simple way, would be my daughter really embodying the illuminated child archetype. Mm-hmm. When I see her darting through the fields and just being amazed by everything that she sees, being fully engulfed in that, or immersed in that miraculous world. And then she really holds that beautiful, luminous aspect of the divine child. And you know when that happens, because you're being pulled into a space, mm-hmm. into this liminal space, and it has the potential to create deep transformation for whoever is involved. Mm-hmm. And that's also when you see an archetypal work.
Fantastic.
So yeah, I'll just give you two extremes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. That's a really good way. Suzanne, I mean, we could go on. I feel like maybe there's an episode 2 coming up where we dive more into storytelling and things like this. But for now and for this episode, I have 2 questions I ask all of my interview guests. First of all, I mean, I have a little reading list already, but is there something that inspired you when it comes to psychology and archetypes that you would recommend for the people listening and watching? This can be podcasts, books, movies, series.
Oh yeah, there's a fantastic podcast called This Jungian Life, mm-hmm. With 3 Jungian analysts who discuss many different topics. I highly recommend that one. And books is incredibly tricky because there are too many titles, too many topics that I can just choose one. So I'll give you a list on that.
Okay. I'll share in the show notes.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, share in the notes. And Google on YouTube, interviews with Carl Jung.
Oh, yeah.
And you get to hear the man speak, mm-hmm. himself. And I just, that also.
Perfect.
That's good.
Fantastic. So my final question, of course, always, what's new in your professional life? What can we look forward to? Is there, I mean, you're here in Hamburg. This is why we talk. You do an event with us tonight.
Yes.
You're at the Mothership Gallery. You're going to read from fairy tales, give it a little perspective. Do you have other things coming up, something we can look forward to? Or very simply, how can people who are interested in talking to you, working with you, how can they be in touch?
Ah, thank you. Good question. Yeah, so the story we're going to do is part of a series called the Ancient Wisdom Series. And we'll be doing more of that, both here in person, which I'm really excited about, and online. So keep tuned into that. It's a fantastic blend of storytelling and art, and in total immersion into the mythical world, mm-hmm. fairy tale world, coming from both a Jungian psychological perspective and really working with the symbols through art. And my partner in crime is Lottie House, and she's absolutely brilliant. So I highly recommend her, especially also for her art workshops that she does here. Then you can get in contact with me for therapy. I do things online, but I think I want to finish off with something that is much more general, and that is the emerging stories and emerging symbols. If you're really, you know, if you're into archetypes, if you're into symbols, then keep an eye out for whatever is emerging. And a little hint is looking for everything that repeats itself, but looking also for the intermingling, entangling images that you see not just in culture but also in nature, and new narratives, mm-hmm. narratives that are showing that besides all the things going on in our world, there is something new also being born.
We'll keep an eye out for that. Suzanne, thank you so much for sharing your time and wisdom with us. I think this episode got a lot of people really reevaluating their consumption behavior when it comes to entertainment, to stories, the way they look at stories, and especially the effect or the underlying ideas behind this to challenge their own archetypes and thinking and role in life. So thanks a lot. And maybe we can do it like this. You're not going to be here for this, but if people have questions, we can do a little survey thing if you want.
Sure.
So if people listen to this and they have questions about it, they can, you can comment the questions. Either you can write them via email on sweetspot.studio, or if you listen to this, for example, on YouTube or something, you just put it in the comment section. Give it the hashtag question for Suzanne. That's Suzanne with a Z, as you can read in the title. And I'm going to pick some of them, and maybe we can do a little follow-up Q&A about those questions. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it sounds good. And thanks so much for having me. It's I love talking to you and love your questions. And
thank you.
Love the topic.
Thank you so much. Then we'll be back on this channel. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Whew, sweet people, that concludes another episode of the Sweet Spot Podcast. We journeyed through the depth of storytelling and archetypes with Suzanne Schrewe, uncovering the nuances between light and dark archetypes, gaining a deeper understanding of the profound impact on our lives and potentially on our brand communication. What was very interesting to me is that I think we covered the hero's journey and the shadow self, and we explored how embracing both the light and the dark aspect of our narrative can lead to a richer, more authentic storytelling. Remember, it's in acknowledging our shadows that we find the light to guide us forward. Along those lines is, I think, my takeaway from what Suzanne said. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. And if you want to continue exploring the world of creativity, entrepreneurship, and storytelling, please subscribe to the Sweet Spot Podcast on your favorite platform. Don't miss out on future episodes filled with inspiration, tips on storytelling, brand building, and design, and how to help you find your sweet spot. If you like what you heard, share this episode with your friends or fellow creatives. Join the conversation on social media using the hashtag SweetSpotPodcast. As always, thanks for tuning in. My name is Mark Zeus. This is the Sweet Spot Podcast, and I hear you on the sweet side.
This podcast is produced by Sweet Spot Studio. New episodes each week, wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you enjoyed the show, leave a rating and subscribe to never miss an episode. Find out more at sweetspot-studio.com.